Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're continuing our conversation on post-traumatic stress disorder by learning more about the healing process. What does PTSD look like? What are some forms of treatment? How can loved ones help? Dr. Carrie Lighting is a psychologist with the VA Medical Center in Sioux Falls. She specializes in PTSD treatment and joins us in our studios at the University of Sioux Falls today. Dr. Lighting, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And we should say a Worthington native as well, coming close to home through VA. Thanks for being here. PTSD, post-traumatic stress injury. We better talk about that for a minute and just say, what's the difference and why does it matter?
Technically, there's not much of a difference. It's more of a conversation that's been started in the last probably 5 or 10 years about whether or not disorder or injury, which one has more of a stigma attached to it. Technically, from the psychiatric disorder standpoint, PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder is the actual name. I think I liked what Secretary Zimmerman was talking about as far as awareness being kind of the main takeaway. We're calling it something, changing the name or calling it something different doesn't change what we're really trying to get at.
And how long have we been calling it this? Because you go back to sort of the beginning of combat, and there's different names, people trying to sort it out. Do you have an idea of when it sort of became an official designation as a disorder or in the big book,
yeah. Right? So that actually happened, I think, right around Vietnam, calling it post-traumatic stress disorder and listing it in kind of the DSM, our Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, for psychiatric disorders. So right around then is when we first called it that. I think before that we called it things like combat stress and other sorts of names. But
getting it in that manual, why does that matter?
Well, from a practical standpoint, it means that we're, at least we know we're talking about the same thing. When I can talk to another provider and use that name of something, they have an idea of what I'm talking about, what sort of symptoms usually fall within that. It also means that if we can diagnose it, then we can also provide specific services for it. We can do research that's actually consistent, and we're actually looking at the same thing as opposed to everyone doing something slightly different, so we don't actually know if what this study did will actually affect a different sample because we don't know if they're looking at the same thing.
Give me a little background about the research and how we know what we know works today.
So a lot of research with our main research that a lot of times we have with our two kind of gold standards treatments kind of started in right around the 80s. They actually both originated looking at treatment for rape victims and looking at kind of the post-traumatic stress disorder reaction to that. And essentially kind of doing a lot of research to see if we compare this to kind of treatment as usual, what happens? And then when we started to see results from that, okay, well, how about we compare them to maybe other treatments, and then let's compare them to each other. And slowly kind of building our case over the last now 30 plus years of research and closing in on 40, consistently finding significant improvements and doing lots of individual differences and looking at, can we look at this over telehealth? Can we look at this with different types of samples? Can we look at this at men versus women? Can we look at this with military samples? Does it matter what type of trauma? And ultimately coming back to our treatments, that kind of our gold standard treatments are good and they'll work. And they'll work regardless of kind of what the trauma is, which is nice to see. And it's nice to know that we can have that and we can offer that to people.
Gold standard treatments, what are they then?
So to be a gold standard treatment, technically what that means is they have to meet certain standards with respect to randomized controlled trials in order to kind of meet that technical standard. So our two kind of gold standard treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder are called prolonged exposure and cognitive processing therapy. And they look very different, but study after study finds essentially equivalent results from both of them. So it's nice to be able to offer two kind of different looking treatments to patients and see which ones they gravitate towards.
Right. We're going to talk a little bit about prolonged exposure therapy. And for that, we have a little audio clip for you to listen to. You haven't heard this before. This is Hawk Meyer. He's a Vietnam veteran who survived a building collapse during the Tet Offensive. He attended a screening of Ken Burns' upcoming documentary on the Vietnam War in Sioux Falls earlier this month. And afterwards, he shared some of his story with South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Jackie Hendry. It was a story he didn't tell anyone for 40 years. But as is the case with many veterans, the story didn't end with the war. Hochmeyer shares how he carried his experiences in Vietnam with him when he came back to South Dakota.
I was in education. I went to college. I got my educational degree, and I taught and coached for 14 years, and then I was a superintendent of schools for 15, and then I retired. And so during that period, and then we had five children, but during that period, when you're a teacher and a coach, there's always something going on. So the mind is always spinning, and see, way back in that hole is the war. See, it's way back there. Okay, and then I became superintendent of schools, and then you got to speak to this committee and that committee, and you got to go out in the community and speak to the veterans and speak to the ladies' quilting club, whoever wants you, okay? So there's always something that's making the mind spin, okay? So I retired, and after 60 days, I told my wife, this is never going to work because the war came back. See, there was nothing to take up that space. Every day talking to the kids, making sure this was done, well, that was done, talking to this teacher. And so I came over to the VA, and I was able to get into the VA, and then I got sick and from Agent Orange. So I have a pacemaker defibrillator that keeps me alive. And I thank God every morning for modern technocracy, whoever invented it. And they put it in out at North Central Heart, Dr. Hibbard and Dr. Olson, who have studied Agent Orange. And so they see a number of our veterans who have pacemaker defibrillators because their heart has been attacked by Agent Orange. And I've had cancer, and I'm beating that. I have diabetes. I have PTSD. But we have five children, we have eight grandchildren, and I'm alive. And I have the best wife in the world. She stuck with me all through all this stuff. And finally, about 4 years ago. Yeah, about 4 years ago, when everybody was at our house for Christmas, I'd been working with Dr. Lithgow at the VA. And he brought me back. He's a great doctor. You know, what do you smell? He'd have me close my eyes and we'd just sit there. What do you smell? What do you hear? What are you doing on this date? And so I recorded, and I still have it, he said, this is what we do. We record every time you're here. And then you play that back to you, and you write down if you missed something. And man, there was always something that was supposed to go in there. And so then when I was all done, he said, now you need to tell your wife, and then you need to tell your children and any grandchildren who the parents think are old enough. And I've done that. Felt good.
It's Vietnam veteran Hochmeyer talking with SDPB's Jackie Hendry. We've got Dr. Carrie Lighting, a VA psychologist, in the studio with us today. Dr. Lighting, the war came back. You hear that often, I bet.
Yeah. The way he kind of described keeping himself busy until retirement and then everything kind of got different, that's not at all uncommon. One of the things that we see quite frequently with PTSD is avoidance, and that's avoiding thinking about, talking about anything related to trauma. That's avoiding people, places, things, sights, sounds, smells. One of the other ways that it can sort of manifest, if you will, is that we keep ourselves so busy that we don't have time, energy, or emotional space to even think about anything related to trauma. And that works really well in this case of like overworking or keeping yourself busy all the time. And then as soon as people retire, they have all this time and all the stuff that they kind of shoved back into that closet and kind of kept closing the door starts creeping out a whole lot more because there's not as much kind of holding against it.
Prolonged exposure therapy then sort of is what it sounds, but walk us through how you do that safely mm-hmm. and without sort of re-injuring someone who's, you know, mentally or psychologically or whatever the term would be, someone who's already been through so much. Now you're making them go through it again?
To some extent, yes. Part of the way prolonged exposure is set up is two pieces. What he was talking about is the imaginal exposure component of it. And the idea with that is that our brain has recorded. I mean, our brain records our memories, our brain keeps them. But what when it comes to PTSD, what can happen is our brain starts to react to the memory itself as if it's really happening every time we have the memory. And the memory itself is dangerous and sends us into kind of this fight or flight sort of reaction. And so the imaginal exposure component is essentially kind of retraining your brain and yourself that I can remember it and I can talk about it and the memory itself is safe. The experience, terrible, agreed, but remembering the memory isn't dangerous in and of itself. And so by going through that with the therapist in session, which is why it always starts there, so that it is a safe mm-hmm. environment and they can practice some relaxation things afterwards and then go home and listen to it. So that, again, it's kind of that if you're trying to learn something new, you have to practice it.
Right.
Same sort of thing, which is why he recorded it and then we'd listen to it outside of session. The idea being is that can we take that terrible experience and not make it less terrible, but make it just the memory of something that's terrible, as opposed to it literally being kind of the monster in the closet.
Right. Memory is a slippery thing. Mm-hmm. What if you don't remember it all? You know something happened, but you really mm-hmm. don't have the memory, but yet it's still causing problems for you. How do you deal with that?
If there are pieces about it that you don't remember, do you have to remember? I mean, it's still causing problems. If there are giant chunks of it that you don't remember, prolonged exposure might not be the best fit. Cognitive processing therapy might be a better fit, which is going to get more at the impact that it's had on your life and kind of how it's affected your belief system about yourself or other people, the world. And so kind of getting at it that way, knowing that both of those treatments are equally effective, it allows us to present both options. We don't want to go into as far as like with an imaginal exposure. We don't want people making up what they think might have happened because that is a slippery slope.
Right.
And we don't want to go down that. But if there are pieces of it that you do remember and those are the pieces that bother you, well, then we talk about those.
How does a person get through the challenges of just going through that? Like knowing that on the other side, this might be worth it. But in the meantime, I have to talk about this. I have to take it home with me. And oh my God, I have to tell other people about this in some circumstances, maybe not all. Mm-hmm. Do you have advice for them to sort of, endure? Isn't maybe not the right word, but how do they prepare themselves to go through the experience of getting healthy?
Yeah, it is an experience. I tell patients all the time, I'm not sure you will ever tell me that you are looking forward to or that you loved your homework, because you won't.
Right. Yeah.
But going back to avoidance is a really great short-term strategy because it works in the short term. You don't have to think about it. It goes away. But it doesn't actually go anywhere for long. And so while avoidance works really great in the short term, it really doesn't work in the long term, which is why you're here in my office to begin with.
Right?
It's because it doesn't work. And so when you have times where you don't want to do your homework or you don't want to come to session, which I can almost promise there will be, right? Let's call it what it is. And that's part of the problem. And that's why you're here to begin with. And so kind of taking essentially kind of the drive that they have anyway,
right?
And applying it to, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it right. If I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it and be done.
Who are you seeing coming in? Are you seeing men, women, Vietnam vets, Iraq, Operation Iraqi Freedom? Is it running the whole gamut?
Yeah, all of the above. Anywhere from, I think, vets who are kind of fresh from post 9/11 conflicts, which are, I mean, some of them are like 22, so they're really young. And I've got vets who are in Vietnam or even older in their late 70s that are coming in. And I didn't deal with this for 50 years. Can I do something? Yeah, let's do something. Let's go.
How about the difference between veterans who saw combat on the ground versus someone who had a distance from it, a sailor who spent a lot of time at sea, a drone, operator, someone like that? Are you seeing people still suffer from PTSD, even if they weren't in the physical space of their combatant?
Less so, but it's not impossible. It kind of depends on the meaning that they've made from their experiences. And going back to, again, what Secretary Zimmerman was talking about, the experiences themselves you can have, the disorder is how much problem is it causing.
Okay.
Right? So you can experience, I mean, there are people who experience all kinds of things on the combat field, but it isn't going to, doesn't cause long-term problems. Excellent. They're resilient. That's what we would like for more people to be. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that anyone is more so or less so. It kind of just depends on essentially kind of what they, the meaning that they've taken from their experiences and how that's created problems or not.
Isn't that one of the great mysteries of this, though, that there could be people side by side in the same unit, a Harrier pilot dropping bombs, and then another Harrier pilot, one has issues, the other does not. And do we have any sense from the research why some people are impacted by the same situation differently?
I mean, we've got lots of ideas. I mean, we know that there are things that we can call risk factors, right? But at the same time, they're so individually based that it's a little bit difficult to predict, mostly because we are different. And a lot of times the beliefs that we have before leading up to any sort of traumatic experience are different. We're so varied. And then the meaning that we make from that then impacting our lives can be different. And so it's a little bit difficult. It's not like A plus B equals C.
All right. So let's talk. We talked a little bit about prolonged exposure therapy as a gold standard. The other kind, the cognitive processing therapies, the way you see the world, what does that look like?
So essentially, cognitive processing therapy came out of essentially cognitive therapy. And the idea being that we all have beliefs about ourselves, the world, other people. They've developed over time. And a lot of times when we experience trauma, they conflict in some way. And a lot of times that will end up with us having beliefs either that are, most of the time, are going to be somewhere in the extreme and negative end of the spectrum, whether that's negative beliefs about ourselves, blaming ourselves for traumatic experiences, which is pretty common, or even experiences where we start to take kind of really general and negative beliefs about the world in total. People can't be trusted. The world's completely dangerous. I'm never safe. I have no control. And the goal for cognitive processing therapy is to identify where are those spots, where are those beliefs that have gotten you stuck in kind of the recovery trajectory, and what can we do to modify, tweak, get us to a place that's maybe not quite so negative, but a little bit more balanced and a little bit more realistic. Again, neither of the treatments can erase what happened. We can't go back. We can't remove memories. We can't remove experiences. But if we can take away kind of that sucker punch quality that a lot of times those experiences have when we think about them, then we're in a much better spot.
Let's talk a little bit about military sexual trauma, because this isn't just a combat trauma or a traumatic experience. Do you see a lot of women, men coming in with sort of rape and sexual trauma in their background?
Absolutely. Military sexual trauma is a big piece. I mean, it can, but not always, right? Well, can lead to PTSD. Sometimes it does. As far as military sexual trauma in general, I mean, the statistics are about 1 in 4 for women and about 1 in 100 for men, which leads to obviously higher rates for women, but pretty significant numbers given for both genders, given the demographics of the military.
Right.
And so as far as treatment wise, if someone experiences military sexual trauma and develops PTSD, our treatments, we offer them the same ones. Again, it's kind of nice to know that for both of our treatments, we started with rape victims, and that's where these treatments started. And then they started doing research and expanding to see, can we treat all kinds of trauma with similar treatments? Mostly because while we have these gold standards for treatments, very much they're tailored for the individual, whether it's their beliefs or their experiences, those pieces are going to determine which way we go and what they do on session to session.
All right. Is there a difference between military sexual trauma and sexual trauma as a civilian? What's the difference?
Difference is essentially what we're calling it. I mean, the difference is just, is it happening while you're in the military? That's what is going to make it be military sexual trauma as opposed to just sexual trauma otherwise.
Is that adding layers for people who are victims, you know, in a space where they thought they were going to, you know, be protected or not? Is it just
it can.
Very similar to being raped in a college setting, for example?
Again, there's... It depends.
Right. Yeah.
I hate that answer. But to some extent, yes, military adds another layer in the sense that depending on who the perpetrator is, whether or not it's someone who is a peer or someone who's above them, that can create their own set of layers. To some extent, that can also happen with civilian sexual trauma as well. I would say that I think with military sexual trauma, you have kind of military training and military culture on top of that, which can sometimes make it hard for the individual to be like, I can't believe that still happened to me.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so then you have to go after that a bit more in treatment if that's kind of where they end up landing on it.
From a PTSD standpoint, when do you know you need help? And, you know, when we talked to Secretary Zimmerman, we're talking just the stress of being in the military in general, the stress of deploying for people who are listening without military experience and saying, yeah, this sounds like me because I had a car accident, because I was raped, because I was abused. When do you know that it's time to reach out and pick up the phone? And when do you know it's just regular stress that we all kind of go through?
I think it's gonna depend on what is it, how is it impacting your life? Is it impacting your life in a lot of different areas? Is it making work hard? Is it making your relationships hard? Is it making kind of your day-to-day life really difficult? And if it is, it's worth going in and at least talking to someone. Maybe it's PTSD, maybe it's something else, but either way, let's figure it out so that life doesn't have to keep being so difficult all the time.
Mm. Are you seeing success on the other side? Are you seeing people come through and find a life that's bigger than what they had before treatment?
Absolutely. That's why I love what I do. I love seeing, old and young, I love seeing young guys be like, they feel more prepared to be able to take on everything else because they've been able to some extent, put certain things to bed. Mm-hmm. You see people being able to kind of take back the reins of their life where they don't feel like the PTSD is controlling them, but that they have some control over their experiences and their reactions and how they're going to do it. I've had quite a few kind of Vietnam guys go through and be like, after 50 years, I can't believe I can actually, like, I am, the way I look at the world is so different than the way I used to.
There has to be some pain to that as well. Pain to looking back and saying, there's an awful lot of years that I carried this around.
Yeah.
That, what do you say? How do you deal with that?
Well, you did it when you were ready.
Yeah.
If you weren't ready before, you being here wouldn't have done a lot of good. Mm-hmm. You would have fought me every step of the way. Mm-hmm. And as much fun as that is, you did it because now is the right time for you. And there's lots of reasons why people aren't ready for treatment. Doesn't mean we can't encourage them or get them to talk to someone. But I think it's recognizing that at least you did something now. You could have never done it. I mean, again, we talk a lot about avoidance, and it's a great short-term strategy because it works really well. And ultimately, what we're asking people to do is to kind of face the things that are in the closet. They're in the closet for a reason because you don't like them, and they're not pleasant, and they're not fun to talk about or think about. And so the fact that you're able to do it, regardless of when you were able to do it, is a big step, and it's worth being proud of, regardless of how long it took you to get here.
You might not know the answer to this, but is it expensive? Is cost causing some people not to sort of seek the mental health treatment they know, or is that not something that you deal with?
Sadly, no, it's not something I deal with. I know that I think there are a lot of good services at the VA, and there's a lot of things that people can do with respect to working with billing and working with those sorts of things. Unfortunately can't offer probably more information than that.
And some people are receiving services possibly for free, depending on what happened. Mm-hmm. It might be service connected.
Correct. Yep.
So talk to someone and find out. Ask those questions. It's worth asking.
Absolutely. And especially with military sexual trauma, regardless of whether that service, if there's a service connected condition related to it, military sexual trauma services for that are covered regardless.
Oh. Family members, how do they sort of walk this walk with their loved ones? When we heard Hawk talking earlier, he had not told this story to his wife, and now she has to go through something as well.
Yeah, and I think it's worth kind of thinking about with respect to like whether or not the veteran chooses to share their story with his or her family. I think that's very much an individual piece, both for the veteran and for the family, and kind of taking stock as to whether or not you really do want to know I think a lot of times we have this compulsion to push people to share with the idea that that's going to be what's best for them. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. If you're not sure how you're going to take it, maybe right. don't push it right away, because that can have an impact too. I think that recognizing that the same thing that we work with our patients in the sense that we can't go back and change what happened, we can't remove memories or remove experiences, but the goal is to keep moving forward and get life back to a place that feels manageable, feels okay, what we want to be.
So it's possible to go through gold standard treatments and not share with someone else necessarily. It could be between you and your therapist, and that could be the choice that you make together.
Absolutely.
Any last thoughts on post-traumatic stress that you want to leave us with? This has been such an enriching conversation, I think, for all of us. I'm getting emails coming in now saying how great it is as we speak. So any final words?
I mean, I think just there's a lot of information out there. I think look for the resources and talk to the people. I know that the National Center for PTSD is a great resource website. It's got a lot of information, both about treatment and kind of how to determine, like, and FAQs about what treatment will look like.
Right.
frequently asked questions from veterans, like, what do I have to do this? What do I have to do here? And I think get your questions answered. Doesn't have to be as scary as it sometimes feels.
Right. We'll put a link up to that website on our website, sdpb.org/inthemoment. Dr. Carrie Lighting is a psychologist with the VA Medical Center in Sioux Falls, specializing in the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. Thank you so much for
Thank
being
you.
Here.